From KCRW, I'm Kim Masters, and this is The Business. The Netflix series Cheer focuses on the stressful lives of junior college cheerleaders fighting for a national championship. Fans of the series will know without being told which set of parents doesn't come across too well. Series creator Greg Whiteley feels kind of bad about that.
I truly enjoy their company. I think they're crazy. Yeah, I think they are. I've had enough conversations with them since it's come out. And I called them right after I started reading online what people were saying about them. And I just asked, are you all right?
Whiteley, who also created Last Chance U for Netflix, tells us about the drama on and off screen as he set out to document the glory and agony of competitive college cheerleading. But first on the News Banter, Oscars so male and so white forever? Stick around. It's The Business from KCRW. I am joined by my colleague and banter, Matt Bellany of The Hollywood Reporter. Hello, Matt.
Hi there.
So the Academy Awards are upon us. And once again, we have this controversy, which is the maleness and whiteness of the nominees. You know, if it weren't for director Bong Joon-ho, we wouldn't have anything but white men in the director's category. We've mentioned, I think, in the past that Greta Gerwig got 6 nominations, including Best Picture, and was not recognized in the directing category. So this issue prompted a Hollywood Reporter to do, I think, a really outstanding piece, Rebecca Keegan, on our staff with data analyst Ben Zosmer. And the results are kind of shocking. The basic premise here is that while the Academy started in 2016, when it was, I think, the second year in a row where Oscar So White had become a trending issue and had come into the consciousness of the Academy started trying to diversify. They have made some strides, but what they concluded that is such a shocking takeaway to me is that the Academy started from such a place of whiteness and maleness that if the Academy continues as planned to increase the diversity of its membership, it will never get to a place where that reflects the demographics of this country.
Yeah, and some of these numbers are pretty shocking considering how much attention the Academy's diversification efforts have received over the past few years. Because if you look to the numbers now, our data analysis found that the Academy is currently 84% white and 68% male. And that's actually an improvement. Back in 2012, it was 94% white and 77% male. So those numbers are better. But the analogy I use is it's like dropping a couple of drops of food coloring into a bathtub.
Yeah, those starting place statistics are really shocking. Nobody noticed, but apparently not.
Well, no, it was always just accepted that the Academy was old white people. And then finally, they said, you know what, that might actually be a problem. And what the numbers suggest is that the Academy has actually been very aggressive over the past few years in inviting new members of color and new members that are female. If you look at the acting category, which is the biggest branch of the Academy, 53% of the new members over the past 5 years are people of color. That's a pretty significant number. And in the director category, 48% are non-white people that have been invited over the past 5 years. That's another pretty big number. If you look at the international new members over the past few years, 39% of the Academy's new members are from outside the U.S. That is absolutely having an impact on the kind of movies that are getting nominated. If you look this year at Parasite, a South Korean film, that film has picture, director, other nominations besides international film.
No acting, but
that picture does have general category nominations. And last year, Roma, a Mexican film from Alfonso Cuarón, ended up winning 3 Oscars, including Best Director.
Yeah, that does show a more open mind. But I was also struck reading a New York Times piece, which talked to a lot of people, including a lot of Black filmmakers and people who lead the Academy, about the impact of the Oscar So White movement and the current year. And I was especially struck by Moonlight director Barry Jenkins saying, you know, if these efforts hadn't been made, what are the odds that his movie would have gotten a serious look? And this is the point, really. You know, when you have this membership that comes from a very specific general demographic, white and male, it's not like they are the people who can anoint what is good in film. You know, some people say, I'm colorblind, I just want to vote for the best film. But what you consider to be the best film is likely to be completely informed by your life experience and not necessarily by some magic artistic metric.
Of course. And, you know, we at The Hollywood Reporter every year, we publish these anonymous Oscar voter ballots. We call them My Brutally Honest Ballot. And the point of publishing those is we get Oscar voters to explain how they vote. And some of these are just absolutely shocking. We published one this year where an actress who is older said that she didn't want the best director to be a non-American. She wanted to vote for an American, so she was going to vote for Quentin Tarantino and not Bong Joon-ho. And that's absolutely ridiculous and, you know, comes from a biased perspective. And everybody brings personal biases to the selection of their preferences. I mean, that's just human nature. And to suggest, oh, you know, we just vote for the best films, we don't have any bias, that's just not true. And we show this every year with these ballots.
Yeah, I mean, that gives the lie to I'm voting for the best film, because what it really is, I'm voting for the best film if it's not a foreign guy, basically. So there's a lot of work to be done here. I mean, the fact that they can never achieve parity with the makeup of this country is concerning, to put it mildly. Now, meanwhile, the entertainment industry, as you know, Matt, has plenty of other problems. We are looking more and more like there will be another writer's strike. We haven't had one since the one in 2007-2008, which cost the LA economy an estimated $2.5 billion and would likely be more costly potentially this year, certainly. Studios are doing what they can to prepare for this possibility by stockpiling scripts.
Yeah, they're not just stockpiling scripts. They're greenlighting shows early in advance of possible shutdowns. They're reviewing scripts that are in their possession to say, hey, what can we do with this before this strike possibly occurs as early as May? This is a very real thing. The economics of how talent is paid are changing so much in the streaming era that the Guild is really, really going to take a hard line, in my opinion, on this stuff. And if I had to bet, I would say it's probably a 70-80% chance that we will have a strike.
Yeah, we're seeing them step up orders, as you say, for things. And just one example is, you know, they extended the number of episodes CBS did of MacGyver just to have more episodes. And when you talk about this issue of compensation, you know, we ran this thing from Ken Ziffrin, one of the top attorneys in this industry, where he goes through the different kind of compensation models in the streaming era. Each studio has like a different variation on how talent is paid. Now, I will be honest and tell you, I tried to read this. I had a very hard time. Is very, very technical and complicated. But what was clear is that these formulas are complicated and different from each other. There's no uniform approach to this. And his bottom line is, none of this is going to be good in terms of how much money the talent ends up getting.
Right. I mean, Ken's analysis suggests that at Disney Plus, which is the new streamer of the Walt Disney Company, which owns Fox and all of its networks and all of its studios, the best thing you can do is to try to get a more traditional profit definition for your actor or your writer. And what that says is the new profit definitions coming out of these streaming services that are being launched by the studios are not as good for talent as the traditional definitions. And that means that the studios are trying to hoard more of that cash.
Yes, as they do. And as we've talked about repeatedly, there is no transparency. So you don't really have any idea how much money your program is making. It is ripe for, I fear, a very protracted conflict. Thank you, Matt.
Thank you.
That's Matt Bellany, editorial director of The Hollywood Reporter.
There's a lot of stereotypes that go on with cheerleading. People think that we're dumb blondes. People think that we just do, like, cheers, like, go team, stuff like that. But we actually put our bodies in a lot of pain.
Oh! Sorry. Are you okay, Morgan?
God.
Morgan Siminer is one of the handful of young students featured in the new Netflix series Cheer. The product of a heartbreakingly difficult childhood in rural Wyoming, Siminer is one of several kids with hard pasts who are part of the elite cheer team at Navarro Community College in Corsicana, Texas. As the series illustrates, cheerleading is a grueling and dangerous sport that demands dedication. Siminer is one of 40 kids fighting for a place on the mat as Navarro looks to compete for its 14th national championship. The school's ultra-successful program draws hopefuls from across the country, including the massively talented tumbler, Lexi Brumback.
I was saved by cheer. Honestly, like, if I wouldn't have came here, I'd probably be sitting in a jail cell right now.
And Ladarius Marshall, a handsome and cocky athlete who grew up largely with absentee parents and faced abuse over his sexuality.
I just didn't care about anything or anyone. And without cheerleading, I would have not made it.
The woman who drives and inspires these young competitors is Coach Monica Aldama, part mother hen, part drill sergeant.
Yo, breathe for a minute. We're doing it again right now. Stunts need to hit. That was not the last time. It's not the last time until you do it right.
Some of the young athletes featured in Cheer have appeared on Ellen and The Late Show with Stephen Colbert, while Reese Witherspoon and Chrissy Teigen have proclaimed their fandom on social media. That makes Cheer a big hit for series creator and director Greg Whiteley, a documentarian who made the acclaimed 2005 film New York Doll, as well as a Netflix doc, Mitt, which went behind the scenes of Mitt Romney's campaigns for president. Whiteley also created the Netflix series Last Chance U, which follows competitive junior college football programs that give troubled kids a shot at getting their lives on track. The choices that you make, you know, you get a group of kids, and this applies to Cheer as well, your strategy for doing it, figuring out who are we following. Do you make that decision at the beginning, in the middle, at the end?
Here's probably the best way I could answer. Ira Glass, I love This American Life.
I did not see that coming. I just
really?
Say. But now that you say it, I say, okay, Ira Glass.
Well, I was very nervous when I was making New York Doll, my first movie. I'd never done a documentary, and I thought, well, how do you do this? And I was such a fan of Ira Glass, and we lived nearish to Royce Hall. My wife and I went and saw him speak. He started describing a filmmaker where a woman went into a high school and she filmed for a year, and she followed two or three students. And one of these students had an incredible story. She got pregnant her senior year, all of the drama around that. It ended up being this incredible movie that Ira was really impressed with. And he asked this filmmaker, how did you know to follow her? And we had a similar conundrum. Every college that we've gone to, whether for football and Last Chance U or most recently with Cheer, you have a number of people who are volunteering to be your main subject. They want to be filmed.
I mean, do you start out saying, which one of you really would like to be spotlighted in this thing?
We never do that.
Okay.
Because everyone would raise their hand.
I would imagine.
With the exception of just one or two.
Right. The ones you probably want.
Yes, that's right. A lot of times that's true. But what this woman said to Ira, and then Ira repeated at Royce Hall, she said, I started just hanging out with these people. And in hanging out with them, it's almost like that experience you have when you're at a cocktail party. You are mixing and mingling, and there is just one or two people that you seem to keep circling back to. There's something you have in common. There's some level of interest. And that's how she picked this girl, and it's how I've learned to pick main subjects that we're focusing on. We've got a team. You know, it takes an army of people to make a documentary series, given the short amount of time that you have to film and the number of hours you have to deliver to Netflix to produce a series. But all of us, we will come together every night, particularly that first week of filming. I will typically say, here's who I like. And there are a few key people whose opinions I really trust. And if I can sense that I can sell them, then I now have
you
confidence
mean your group,
that we can go,
like,
yeah, within the group. The,
sometimes people might be like, eh, or, oh yeah, her.
Yeah. And if they kind of go, eh, I know I either have some work to do or I've picked the wrong person, but I've noticed that that usually is not the case. That it's pretty obvious to the three or four of us that are making that decision. It becomes really clear. There may be people on the periphery that people will try and lobby. And in the interest of just hedging our bets, we'll go, okay, well, let's kind of follow them. But in the 6 years now of doing it, it's always the same four or five people that we mentioned in the first meeting or two.
Wow.
It's always those four or five people.
First instinct is correct,
I guess. Or it's maybe if I were to choose four or five other people, human beings just tend to be interesting. And when you invest that kind of time in them, you're going to find something great about it.
Well, I thought you could, you know, this rival school for Navarro, which is 40 miles away or something. I thought, it's clear, it seems, you know, you could just as easily have flipped a coin and said, I'll go there.
Uh-huh.
Is that true? You're smiling because, of course, we wonder whether that's going to happen.
It might.
It might. But I don't know whether there was a reason that you met Monica, the coach, or obviously those two schools are the schools.
Yeah.
Was there a reason you went to Navarro first?
Well, the president of the school wouldn't let us come to TVCC. So that's
well,
the first
let
reason.
Let that out.
Yeah. But the second reason was Monica. I just met Monica and I knew that that's who I wanted to hang out with. I just knew that that's where I wanted to spend time. There was a really interesting collision between her grit and competitiveness and a deep sense of caring for her team that I thought, I know this will be great.
I'm not going to give away much at all for people who haven't seen Cheer, but one of the cheerleaders who very talented and you feel like this girl is somebody they're going to really rely on. And then, oops, she's out of the picture because she's injured. And I don't know if you had said, we're going to follow her. And then suddenly she couldn't. I mean, there's drama, obviously, because she's no longer able to compete. Just adjust and say, well, can't stay with her.
She was not one of the main five. No. We really liked her, but for whatever reason, there were five people that jumped. And I think if I was committed to those five, and whether they made it throughout the whole season or not is inconsequential to us. I think it's still something interesting. If somebody is, their hopes and dreams come down to making it on the mat and being there in Daytona, but they get injured, that's still a worthwhile story to tell. I mean, you can still cut away to them during Daytona as they're off the mat. And right. That's just as poignant a shot as them nailing their stunt on the mat.
So when you have these kids, do you tell them, like, we will follow you everywhere? Or do they have the ability and do they exercise that to say, you know what, we're not down for you to be here right now?
Oh, my gosh. Yeah, we would never go anywhere where we were not welcome. Anybody at any time could say, hey, you know, not today. And that happened a lot.
That does happen.
Oh, for sure. That's... Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that may be the key difference between reality TV and docuseries. In reality TV, at least presumably, you're paying those people. And with that pay, that compromises the relationship to a degree where they now feel obligated to do the things that you would need them to do to produce drama. We feel differently. We want you to treat us as you would a reporter for the New York Times. We're coming in and we're going to document this story as much as you're willing to allow us to. But at any point, if you're not comfortable with the process or even on a particular day, you're not comfortable, you just say stop. And we always explain that at the top. We only want to be around at the degree that you are comfortable with us being around.
Now, some of these kids, I mean, they all have these amazing backstories. Hard in some cases. Well, I think all of them in different ways hard. You go to Wyoming. Do you go once? Do you go in the beginning, the middle? Do you go twice? What do you do?
We only had the money to go once to Wyoming. And we only had the money really to make a small handful of visits to the five that we were following. And even of all five, we couldn't go as often as we wanted. We went twice to Chicago, where Jerry is from. We went once to Florida, where we could do both Ladarius and Gabby. And then we did a follow-up shoot in Florida, but that's all the money we had. I would love to do more. I wish we could do more home visits.
Yeah, I wonder whether the purse strings ever loosen on that one.
Yeah.
Well, this may not be the time when Netflix is loosening purse strings, but I'll say that. You don't have to. Coming up after a short break, Cheer creator Greg Whiteley says he needs to apologize to one set of Cheer parents. And you know which one if you've watched the series. You're listening to The Business from KCRW.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is The Business, and I'm Kim Masters. We're talking to Greg Whiteley, creator and executive producer of the sports docuseries Cheer on Netflix. Cheer follows the real-life drama of the Novero Community College cheerleading team, with young competitors enduring punishing practices involving dangerous stunts as they look to win Novero's 14th national championship. As the series begins, the most famous member of the team is Gabby Butler, who already has a massive social media following from years of making cheer-related YouTube videos and putting in appearances with other teams across the country. Gabby's parents are hard-driving, pushing her to make those appearances, cash in on sponsorship deals, and keep her social media presence up and her weight down. But at Novero, Gabby's focused on the same thing as everyone else, practicing to perfection in the hopes of winning the big competition in Daytona, Florida.
The feeling of going out on the floor and performing that 2.5-minute routine. It's like this adrenaline rush that you get that you're just like, wow. It's scary, but you just have to trust your teammates.
there's also a sort of a lesson in capitalism in the series, because this company, Varsity Sports, controls so much about cheerleading, and they restrict your ability to shoot the ultimate competition. And yet, I guess their CEO sits for an interview. Is that who you had?
Yeah, the CEO, Bill Seeley, I called him right when I knew we would be making a series. And he was understandably guarded. And he explained to me, we've allowed other doc film crews or reality TV crews to come and film. And we've never been happy with the way cheerleaders are portrayed. And I started to walk him through. And to his credit, he went and watched Last Chance U. And the conversations got better. He started to say, oh, okay, I can see that you guys are real filmmakers. You're interested in telling the real story. We still have some reservations about if you were to come with this full crew, we've got hundreds of teams that are there competing. You're going to be in the way. I kept trying to explain to him, no, I know we can get this done. After I went to Daytona and I realized the Swiss watch that is the Daytona end of the year championship, it is hundreds of teams that compete and it is controlled chaos. And I can imagine, I don't think anybody should be blaming Varsity Sports for not wanting us to come and film. The thing that was disappointing to me is I really felt like we were very close to having some agreement that would allow us to go there. And at the last minute, I think they just got cold feet. They started adding on extra restrictions with just days to go. I don't even know if Bill Seeley was busy planning the competition. It was as we were dealing with his lawyers. And, you know, for them, they look at it and they go, well, what's in it for us? There's nothing in this for us. Why should we lie? It's only downside for us. And I think that was the logic behind at the end. We could not meet their demands, which included an element of creative control. They would have say over how the footage was used. That's, and I could never allow that.
Cannot happen. Yeah.
Yeah. And so, unfortunately, those talks broke down and we weren't allowed to have our cameras film that championship, which we had been building the whole year for.
So did you have this moment where you're like, oh my God,
yeah.
I can't believe it.
Yeah, I thought, yeah, this is maybe the end of
this
my
is a
career.
Killer, right, yeah. A killer for the series. I would imagine how much panic there would be, really. Like, and yeah. Then, so you just say to people, get out your phones?
No, here's what we did. In doing our research and trying to explain to Varsity what kind of footprint we would need, I just started looking at any kind of footage I could find online of past championships. And there was a ton. Looking through all this footage, it occurred to us, we could just take footage that people uploaded with their phones and we could pretty much cobble together the Daytona experience. And so that's what we did.
Going forward, assuming there's going to be another season of this, which has not at this moment been announced.
Yeah, still working that through.
But I just see a company that has a lot of control over a lot of aspects of cheer seeing an opportunity, and I wonder how that will play itself out.
I do too. Their argument would be they have built a very successful company that they will tell you, we have done a lot to put cheerleading on the map, and we have a lot invested in this activity, and so we just have to be very careful. I mean, if I'm being honest, they're probably as controlling as I would be tempted to be if the shoe was on the other foot. I get it. What I hope is they'll see that being open with a filmmaker like myself and a filmmaking team like the one we have is really going to only grow the pie, I believe. Most people don't know cheerleading. They don't understand it.
Right. This has done more for cheerleading, people understanding it than anything I can think of.
I think so too.
You know, there's a parent or two where fans of the show are like, geez. And when you must know when you're shooting them that they're going to play somewhat horribly.
You're talking about Gabby's parents.
Yes.
Yeah.
Gabby.
This rice.
Did you make the video?
No, I need to make it.
Really?
Seriously?
I told you.
Okay, I need that tonight. I have to send it to her.
Okay.
You need to stop procrastinating on stuff. You had all day long to do it.
Okay, but...
Okay. You have no defense when you start with okay, so just shut up at that point and say I'm sorry.
Okay.
I'll be honest with you. I owe them an apology. I think that there is a way that I have made movies in the past where a main subject or somebody I'm following around will say or do something that either makes them look silly or conniving. And I don't shy away from showing that stuff. But what I try and do is spend enough time with them that I could give a greater context to who they really are. And so that instead of just dismissing them, you as an audience will watch them and go, well, you know, am I kind of like that? I might be kind of like that. I shouldn't judge this person that harshly. And so I feel like that's a way, as a storyteller, I can have my cake and eat it too, where I want to have those moments that are funny or...
I mean, I don't know if you affirmatively say somebody's the bad guy because it's more drama.
Well, it's a very cheap way to move a story forward. If you can find somebody to root against, that's a shortcut almost invariably to creating empathy for your protagonist, for your main character, who you want the audience to root for. I think there's a better way. I think even villains become more interesting when you understand why they do what they do.
So you owe them an apology because...
Well, here's what's hard.
I mean, they had more than one bite at the apple in this series. And every time the apple has a little bit of a worm in it, I think.
To a degree. But I like them. I truly enjoy their company. I think they're crazy.
Are they mad at you?
Yeah, I think they are. I've had enough conversations with them since it's come out. And I called them right after I started reading online what people were saying about them. And I just asked, are you all right? And
aside from the show itself, their daughter has a huge social media following. So they get a double-barreled social media blowback, I'm assuming. But go ahead.
Yes, I think that's right. But I think what I regret the most is my true feelings for them as people didn't come out in three dimensions in our telling of their story. I don't know how I would have done it differently because 6 hours seems like a long time, but it's not. I mean, you really have to hit your marks. And if you're not a main character, you're not getting a lot of time on camera. They got a fair amount of time, but they were largely used to help move Gabby's story forward. And I think what they would argue, and I think they'd be right, is, hey, we let you into our home. You filmed a whole dinner. You saw how much love Gabby has for us and how much we have for her. His argument was, people are accusing me of using my daughter. I'm living off my daughter's income. I have a very successful business. That doesn't come out. I haven't taken one dime of my daughter's. And he's 100% right about that.
Well, it's true. I didn't know that he had a very successful business. That's not to say that they don't drive her very hard.
Yeah, no, true. And I assume he had a successful business. I'm only going on what he's told me. And we did visit him in his office. And
right.
So I can't.
There
I,
was an office.
I didn't go through the books. Right. So I don't know. But I believe him when he says he's not taking his daughter's money. So I think you're fair as an audience member to saying they are what they call very sticky parents. They're very involved in Gabby's life. They will micromanage this girl. But, you know, I'm not Gabby's dad. I don't know Gabby the way he would know her. I can easily sit back and judge what I think I could have done a better job as a storyteller and fleshing out the other elements of them. One thing that is admirable about them is they do spend a lot of time together. I know for a fact that he has anonymously paid the tuition of other cheerleaders on the team who couldn't pay their tuition.
Wow.
And he's probably pretty mad at me that I wouldn't include that detail. And the only reason, I just don't know how to include it. Yeah, if it's anonymous, that's one. But also, I don't know how I would tell it. I don't know who he paid that tuition for. It was told to me by somebody else. And so, yeah, I lament. Everybody I film, I would want them to have me back. And so far, that has been true. And I hope it's true for them because I want to make it right.
So at least she's not back at Novara.
We just got word last week. She's coming back to Novara.
Oh, she's coming back. Uh-oh.
Yeah. Now, I don't know if we're coming back, but if we are.
Greg Whiteley is the director and executive producer of Cheer and Last Chance You on Netflix. Thank you for coming in.
Oh, it's such a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
And that's The Business. Caitlin Parker produced and edited today's program, and Paul Smith mixed the show. You can stream The Business as well as other great KCRW podcasts on the KCRW app. I'm Kim Masters. We'll see you next week on The Business.